Welcome to Hearing Voices, the best in public radio from NPR. I'm Larry Massett. Our show today is Predator. All of us are predators in one way or the other, of course. That's a law. Even panda bears, even cute little bunny rabbits have to eat. But in certain cases, predation appears to go beyond the bounds of nature. It becomes questionable. For example, how would you feel about having a werewolf in your family? Would that be a good thing or a bad thing? Hilary Frank tells us how this has worked out for one family.
The Peerys grew up in rural Idaho. When their parents went out, the oldest son, Doug, was left in charge of his four younger siblings. Doug was the kind of guy who ruled the last three rows of the school bus through a combination of force and psychological pressure. He told other kids that the bus driver signed an agreement putting him in charge of the back of the bus. He wore a bomber jacket. He rode a motorcycle. Still, his parents thought he seemed responsible enough when it came to his brothers and sister. There was a lot they didn't know.
If I had to be there tending these dang kids, I was going to make it fun for me too, you know.
Doug often subjected his three little brothers to what he calls bravery tests. He would do things like stuff them in a sleeping bag and tie them to a tree limb, or snap huge rubber bands at their skin until they stopped flinching.
I really hesitate to tell this one because it could have been... we had this iguana, okay, this big lizard about 3 feet long, and it died. Well, I was so attached to this thing that I, of course, just didn't want to take it out and bury it, so I put it in the freezer and kept it. Well, this was a fun thing for all of us boys to take out of the freezer and thaw out and play with it, you know, and then we got tired of playing with it, then we'd put it back in the freezer, you know, and we'd freeze it again, and after about a year and a half of this, we decided we needed a new bravery test. So we thought, what can we do? I think we should boil and eat the iguana. That would be the ultimate bravery test. Well, we put it in a pot. We got the biggest pot my mom had, and we stuffed it in there and boiled it, you know. Well, it's been boiling about 5 minutes. Probably done by now, you know. And we got the thing out of there, and honest to goodness, we ate some of that lizard.
Oh, my God.
I even ate some. And they
really?
Even ate some.
And I'm so. What did it taste like?
You know, at that point, it actually tasted kind of like sawdust.
Doug did all the bravery tests he made his brothers do. He was right in there with them. But they were on their own when it came to one of Doug's long-running babysitting pranks. I spoke with Doug and with his youngest brother, Mike, who was the easiest target. They're 10 years apart.
We were convinced for 3 or 4 years of our lives, I think, that he could actually turn into a werewolf. We would walk out of the house, and then you'd hear this, and it literally stop you in your tracks. And you just knew he was out there somewhere.
Again, here's Doug.
We had a pasture in the back, and it was about maybe half an acre. And they'd go out clear up to the back fence, and that's where they like to sleep out. So this is the perfect place for me to stalk them in the night, you know, and sneak up and be the werewolf. So I would kind of just crawl out into the shadows, you know, and I could hear them out there talking, and I'd be sneaking up to the bushes and I'd go, "Roo!" And I'd hear dead silence. And then I'd hear one of them go, "Duck's a werewolf."
Doug kept this up for years, and the kids began to dread it whenever their parents went out, knowing something scary would happen to them. Until finally, it all came to a head one night. Mike was 8 years old. The middle brothers were 11 and 13. Doug was 18. It began the way it usually did, out in a pasture, surrounded by potato fields. Here's Doug.
We had a full moon, which was wonderful. And I kind of got to where the moon was silhouetting me, and they couldn't really see me. And I stuck a bunch of weeds down in my glasses so they're poking out all around, you know, and then I kind of rose up out of the weed patch, you know, and they could see the silhouette with all this looked like hair poking out, you know, so that convinced them. I mean, I was totally growing hair. I was completely a werewolf, so run for your life, you know.
And we all, of course, knew that the best thing to do was to get out of our sleeping bags and run as fast as we could to the house, because that was the sheer shelter.
What were you afraid that Doug was going to do to you?
Well, it's just the whole idea of being chased around in the dark, and it's not like there was ever a lack of physical contact. I mean, it literally was a situation where you were scared for your life. And we knew that Doug was in between us and the house somewhere. And as we were running to the house, Doug was just sitting on the roof in a sort of a gargoyle position, just as still as the night, and just staring at us, watching us. And so we just kind of slowly kind of just walked underneath him and ran into the house.
Well, now I'm peeking in the windows, I'm rattling the doors more, I'm trying to get in, and they're running from door to door trying to lock all the doors up. And I was always right on their heels as they made it to the door, and I made sure that I just didn't quite catch them, you know, and they would run in and slam the doors. Just at about the time they thought they were all safe, I snuck over and took the breaker, and I shut the breaker off to the house.
And then all of a sudden, boo, the lights go out. And it's pitch dark in the house.
It was like, we're all going to die. I mean, it was just that they had no safe place they could think of to go until one of them finally thought, get to the car. You know, we got to get in the car and lock the doors.
And as we were all sitting in there looking around at each other, we realized that my brother Steve didn't make it out of the house.
And then the next thing I know, I'm in the house alone.
Let's introduce another brother. This is Steve.
And of course, then my fear went out, you know, through the roof, you know. It was like,
yeah.
And then I see him look in the patio window at me.
Well, I was still around back, so I thought, well, Steve is still in there. I could see in the darkness, I could see him rocking in the chair. Well, I'll get Steve.
He snuck into the house, and he saw my brother Steve just sitting on the couch. And Steve just said, I don't care. Kill me if you want.
And that was when I told him, you know, just kill me or whatever. Be done with this, however you want to end it. I mean, I'm done.
I don't think we ever played it again after that point, you know.
These days, the brothers are all quick to say that Doug was playing werewolf, that it was just a game. None of them carry resentment towards him. Though when they were kids, clearly feelings were running a bit hotter. Around the same time that Doug had his little siblings convinced he wanted their blood, he got into a motorcycle accident that nearly killed him. He broke every bone in his face, one arm, and one irreplaceable kneecap. The force of the crash made the helmet, along with his scalp, shoot off his head. It took around 350 stitches to sew him back up.
You know, when I came home from the hospital, I had my leg in a cast, my arm in a cast, I was in a wheelchair, my face was all banged up, and my brothers say, Mom, we'll take Doug down the road in his wheelchair for a walk, and so he can have some air. And so she goes, okay, and I get in the wheelchair, and they get me out on the highway and run as fast as they can, and then let go. And I'm like, you know, going down the road in the wheelchair, heading for the ditch. And just about the time I go in the ditch, they catch up to me and straighten me out and go again, you know. So this was kind of a get even with me kind of a time. And there was nothing I could do about it, and they'd had a great fun with me that time, you know. So I guess that, you know, I was expecting a lot of sympathy and poor Doug, and no, it wasn't that at all. It was, let's get some revenge for all this time.
Revenge came in other forms as he got older. When Doug had kids of his own, to his horror, his oldest son Corey turned out to be exactly the same kind of babysitter that Doug had been. Doug would come home from a night out and find himself pulling Corey aside and saying things like, "Next time, try and tie the rope a little looser around your brother's neck." Steve, the brother who told Doug, "Just kill me," is also a parent these days, of four daughters. And like Doug, he's had moments flashing back to the days when Doug babysat.
I remember this one time, he came out with his box and he said, "Look what I found out in the street." And you open this box and he had his finger sticking up through the bottom of the box.
Mm-hmm.
So that all you could see was this bloody finger in there, you know. I mean, I freaked out over that for years. I still remember it vividly. Of course, after we saw how freaked out we were by it, he showed us how it worked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I did it to my own kids, if you can believe that.
You did?
And, you know.
Why? Why would you want to freak them out?
I don't
know.
Like I remembered it so vividly, and I thought, well, that was, you know, and I think back on it, and I go, well, it was kind of cool, actually, how he did it. So here I go, and I'm going to try it with my own kids, okay? And I lift up the box, and my oldest daughter just broke into tears. And I apologized all over myself for a week or two afterwards to her.
Yeah.
And I hope she's probably going to have as crappy a memory of that as I did when I seen it the first time, you know?
Yeah. Did you feel sort of like you were in Doug's shoes, like you knew what it
yeah,
felt like
almost,
to be him?
And I catch myself wanting to tease him, too, like he did
mm-hmm.
sometimes, you know? In a fun sort of way, but my wife will go, "You know, you're acting just like Doug."
As an adult, Doug has gone to each of his younger brothers and apologized for how he treated them. But he also thinks if they'd been less aggressive with each other as kids, they wouldn't be as close now.
I know families that have grown up more mellow than us,
mm-hmm.
and they get along fine, and they're very civil, and they're very happy to see each other, but they're almost like, when they see each other, they shake hands. And I'm like, give me a break. You haven't seen your brother for 6 months, and you're shaking his hand? I mean, we're grabbing each other and bear hugging, and we're jumping up and down, and you know, it's a whole different relationship as far as I see. Like people who've been through traumatic experiences together, you know. Maybe that's why, you know, you feel like you've been through that and survived it all together, and so it creates a deep bond or something, maybe. So I think we're closer because of it, actually.
Did part of you know that when you were younger, that it might make you closer when you grew up?
Well, you know, I think maybe subconsciously you do, because after every time you would feel somewhat closer, you know. So I don't think as a kid you actually sit down and think, if I do this, it's going to make me closer to my brother. You just do it if it feels that way. You know, you just tend to do the things that make you grow closer together. And those are the things that we did that drew us together, so we continued doing those kind of things.
When I ask the other brothers if they'd do it all over again, they all say they would.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved my childhood.
Even with all the terror and danger that was there, you would still do all of it over again?
Absolutely. I look back on those years with complete fondness.
What big teeth you have was produced by Hilary Frank for This American Life, thislife.org. Next, writer Mark Allen has the story of the worst dog in the whole world, Beatrice, the evil poodle.
I don't have much time, so I'd better tell my story quickly. I spend a lot of hours relaxing on my fifth floor fire escape, taking in the surroundings and looking at the people in my neighborhood. It's like my front porch. Over the years, I've come to know a lot of the people on my block, and I like them all, except for her. Her name is Beatrice. She's a toy poodle. Beatrice has typical poodle hair, bright white, trimmed into one of those poofy toy poodle looks you see in dog shows. She has pink nail polish that her owner has painted on her dog toenails, which are too long and click on the pavement when she walks. All the kids run to pet her. She's the block mascot. Sometimes they turn on a radio and play music, and Beatrice wiggles and yaps and dances for little scraps of pizza. Ugh, look at them all down there, clapping along. Everyone loves Beatrice. Everyone but me. Beatrice the poodle has a dark side. In fact, that little dog is evil. Her canine body is just a disguise for a force as old as the universe itself. When our world is gone, this entity inside Beatrice will find another world, another disguise. But now it's in our dimension, inhabiting this wobbly, lovable, yapping little poodle. What's more, Beatrice knows I know about her. And that's why I catch her staring up at me. I'm the one you haven't fooled. The one missing piece in your apocalyptic jigsaw puzzle. Oh, if only I would fall into place, Beatrice. If only I would submit. Aha, but I won't. I'm up here, and you're down there. You horrible little poodle. I always knew it would be just a matter of time before I paid for my knowledge. One beautiful spring morning, I pour myself a cup of coffee and go out on the fire escape to enjoy the day. The street is unusually quiet. In fact, there's no one around at all. And I mean no one. Not even any cars, no birds, no insects. Total silence. I stare and listen in disbelief. Then I hear a sound in the distance. A tiny clicking. Coming from deep inside my apartment building. It's coming closer, up the stairs. I want to move from my fire escape, but I can't. Clickety-click. Closer it comes. Clickety-click. I know Beatrice is in my hallway, right outside the apartment door. I hear her toenails click on my front doorknob as she turns it, opening my door. I hear her clickety-click feet walk into my apartment. I hear the clickety-click enter the living room, the bedroom, and stop right below me at the window, right behind me. I can't move at all. She moves her small poodle arms around my head, placing her paws on my eyelids. I feel the rough, black, pebble-like soles of her feet, the long, cold pink toenails, the perfume-scented fur. She grabs my hair with her paws and pulls, dragging me across the room. I want to speak, scream, make any sound at all. But I can't. She drags me out of my apartment and into the hallway. She tugs me over each step, down the winding flight of stairs. Click, thud, click, thud. She drags me to the back of the building, past the mailboxes, past the garbage cans. Beatrice pulls me into the darkness of the basement. I see her flickering shadow dance against the brick wall as she drags me closer to the hot, stinking furnace. With my head sideways against the concrete floor, Beatrice moves into my field of vision. I see her face close up for the first time. Her poodle puff hair, the balls of fur at the end of her ears, those awful tiny teeth, and her eyes. Other people see cute little poodle eyes. I see two black voids as wide as the universe, eyes as deep as the accumulated collective human consciousness of 1 trillion years of mankind's regret, hate, and despair. I open my mouth to scream, and as I do, my tongue slowly unfurls onto the dirty basement floor. Without haste, Beatrice reaches down with her skinny poodle leg and stomps on my flaccid tongue, smooshing it into the floor. I am not allowed to speak. Beatrice is now moving quickly all around me in the flickering light. She shoves me inside the little door on the upper part of the furnace and shuts the grill. I'm looking out through the slits. Behind Beatrice on the wall is the on switch to the furnace. I see a small dot reflected in each of her eyes and realize it's the reflection of my face. Keeping her eyes locked with mine, she slowly reaches behind her and places her paw near the switch to activate the fire in the main part of the furnace. I just keep gazing into her eyes. I hear her pink toenails click against the knob of the metal switch.
Allen has since moved from Manhattan to upstate New York, where there are not quite as many boodles. You're listening to Predator. This is a mix of music and animal sounds created by the group Matmos for the Museum of Natural History in Los Angeles. Hearing Voices will be right back with more wild animals.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Predator on Hearing Voices. Big fish eat little fish, you know that. And ducks eat fish. And people eat both ducks and fish. But when you put them all together, fish, ducks, and people, it turns out the diet of choice is Wonder Bread. So it has been for decades in the town of Linesville, Pennsylvania. At certain times of year, carp gather at the Linesville spillway in such numbers, so thick, that the local mallard ducks can walk on their backs. And then, well, see for yourself.
The diet of fish is all everywhere.
There's thousands of fish and they're very hungry.
The Linesville Spillway is the second largest tourist attraction in the state of Pennsylvania next to the Liberty Bell.
Look at that guy. He's huge.
I think it ranks second to Gettysburg.
You can see in front of us 30 or 40 people, each of whom have a couple loaves of bread in their hands.
How much is this bread?
These are a dollar a bag.
It's a loaf of sliced bread. I think it's like Wonder Bread or something, and it just works great to throw them kind of like a frisbee.
Grandma, Grandma, where's this river at? You know the one where ducks be walking on a fish's back. Grandpa said I could have a piece of bread to break in little bits and throw it over the edge.
There you go, fishies.
And they just try and suck it all in.
I like to watch them fight.
And they're fighting over it, and then the ducks just walk on top of the fish because they're trying to get to the piece of bread, grab it, and keep right on moving.
Whoa, Daddy!
Hey, did you see it? Look at them go. Give another slice. I think they'd like to eat some more. Grandpa said, I can have a piece of bread to break in little bits.
I've been coming down here since I could walk, probably.
Oh, look at that one with his mouth wide open.
It's not the most attractive thing in the world. Maybe it would be better if we had some, you know, glorious mountain in our backyard or something, but that's not what we have. We have where the ducks walk on the fish, and that's what makes people want to come here. And otherwise, they wouldn't probably want to come here.
I opened my door to get the newspapers for the day, and that was the headline on the Meadville Tribune was "No More Bread to the Fish."
I found out about it in the daily newspaper.
My name is Cindy Whiteman. I own the Laughing Duck Bookstore and Coffee House in Linesville, Pennsylvania.
My name is David Schaefe. I have lived in the Linesville area almost all of my life.
The Meadville Tribune, Linesville, Pennsylvania. A tradition that is almost 70 years old at Pima Tuning Spillway will come to an end on January 1st.
Visitors to the spillway will no longer be allowed to throw bread or bread products to the thousands of carp below.
Pete Houghton, manager of the Pima Tuning State Park, said visitors have been tossing a little bit of everything to the fish, including cupcakes, bagels.
My name is Pete Houghton. I'm the park manager at Pima Tuning State Park.
Some of which are not good for fish.
We've been feeding up there for 50 years, and or 60, I don't know. But back then, we had 200,000 people come to the facility with a bag or two bags of bread and threw single-sliced bread out there. You go up today, and what I don't like, people bring big garbage bags full of stuff that we don't want in the water.
Dad, can I dump this out?
I know people that cut up chicken and threw in watermelon, and that's not right.
We've seen birthday cakes tossed in the water.
Winkies and cracker boxes.
Corn chips are fairly popular.
Get that bagel over there!
We've got baked gold assorted donuts from Stroman's and Edmund's plain donuts.
Their stomachs must be aching.
Carp are on a strict diet beginning January 1st of next year. State Park System has decreed that only state-approved pellets of fish chow sold at the spillway will be okay for the carp.
In the town where ducks walk on fishes.
The reaction of the people was one of shock.
Can you believe this?
Wonderment.
You want to take away the bread, and then you take away the fun. That's like mending up the crack in the Liberty Bell or something. Can I help you?
I have a loaf of bread.
I'm sorry, son, but I have to say.
You've been doing this since 1934.
The last loaf will be thrown today.
Fish don't look sick to me.
And to take away the draw to the area would just obliterate our businesses.
But with no bread in the water, could we be dead in the water? With no bread in the water, could we be dead in the water?
Very soon there were petitions signed by thousands of people.
And ultimately, they held a public meeting.
Over 350 people piled into the Linesville High School auditorium for a public hearing to tell officials from the Bureau of State Parks they shouldn't have made this decision without informing residents or lawmakers.
Jim Lasko.
Economically, you're going to kill our area. Shame on you.
Kathleen Caprice.
Are you going to have bread police out there? You gonna slap handcuffs on three-year-olds? Bullcrap.
Wanda Romali.
There are hundreds of us in this part of Pennsylvania that are gonna lose our ability to earn a living with the decision that you've made. Who would ever think that one of the ugliest things in Linesville is our crown jewel? Please don't mess with it.
Dead in the water with no bread. Could we be there in the water?
I'd like to watch them fight.
Shame on you.
Are you going to have bread police slap handcuffs on three-year-olds?
Hundreds
hundreds of locals who came out to Linesville to support a longtime family tradition have gotten their way, at least for now. The department is taking the next year to reevaluate their decision and work more closely with the public to reach an acceptable solution.
This is a victory for the people who turned out at that meeting.
I wouldn't call it a victory yet. The case got continued to next year, you know, and hopefully the lesson is that they can be more open and communicate more with the people around here about things that they're going to do in this state park that are going to have some kind of impact on the people of this town. Why must we lose our
haven't changed the rules down here then, I guess, huh?
They kicked it back for another year, so we got another year of bread.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here, get some more bread.
Grandpa said, I gotta have a piece of bread to break in little bits and throw it over the edge.
Loaves and Fishes was produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister of Long Haul Productions.
Why must we lose our...
The music was composed by Tim Fight. Here's a little more of it.
On a fish's back. Grandpa said, I gotta have a piece of bread to break in little bits and throw it over the edge. Hey, did you see it? Look at them go. Give another slice, I think they'd like to eat some more. Grandpa said, I gotta have a piece of bread to break in little bits and throw it over the edge. Today, but with no bread in the water, could we be dead in the water? With no bread in the water, could we be dead in the water?
Tim Fight, spelled F-I-T-E, timfight.com. You're listening to Hearing Voices. And now that we've heard about the fish and the ducks, let's go for something much, much bigger.
That is the call of a bull elk. That is when bull elk mate, they go into rut, and they use this call to announce that they are there. They gather up a harem of cows and defend that harem against intruding bulls. And while much is made of the tremendous fights they get into, they don't really do a lot of fighting. They do a lot of head pushing and hauling and grunting and antagonistic stuff, but it's mostly all a big show. But while they are so occupied, that's when you get a chance to hunt them. They have a variety, a wonderful variety, of tonal calls, tonal variations, and they call it bugling, but to me it's more like a flautist. Just a beautiful, melodious sequence of notes. I've got another call over here, and this is another sound that bull elk will make, and I think it's just chillingly beautiful. You hear that on a frosty morning as the sun is just coming up and it sends chills down your spine. Now, there are calls that make sounds like cows and calves. And this, too, will attract a bull because he is in the midst of picking up a harem. They'll try and gather up as many as 12 cows and calves and breed them. So if you make a sound like a cow or a calf, this attracts them, too. That would be a cow. Listen to this. It's a subtle difference, but you can pick it up in the wood. A little bit higher pitch is the calf. It's the same kind of sound. That's the calf. Cow. That's kind of standard elk calling equipment. Hunters fill up their pockets and necks with all kinds of things. They have things dangling from them, knives and calls and things like that. And it's the most exciting form of hunting in the world. Because rather than you being the aggressor, you are fooling the animal. You are tricking the animal. And you've got to be not an aggressor, but you've got to be very good at imitating nature to do that. You've got to fit in, not go out there and be Mr. Macho. You've got to learn nature's ways to do it. And when you see a bull elk bearing down on you from about 50 yards away with blood in his eye, that's a moment of glory.
Our visit with Hunter Norm Strong was produced by Barrett Golding and Coulter Langham. Moving now from the sound of the elk to the smell of the deer.
I think pretty much you can bank anywhere from November 10th through the end of November, they're rutting, and they're rutting hard.
Yeah. You can just smell the heat and smell the rut right in the air. You can just, jeez, we've kind of coming into it. The bucks, you can smell the bucks too.
I think more so the bucks, because at this point in time, even November 1st, they're preparing themselves, and they're taking their back legs, and they're rubbing them together, and they're urinating on their legs, and that stinks. And that, you know, and that what happens is they're hawks. They're trying to get on their glands. And that's all premature stuff. And just getting ready, you know, he's feeling it a little bit. It all comes down to, again, deer movement.
Deer movement, yeah.
Deer don't move around as much in the daytime. The bucks at time of year will, because they're trying to find where the in-heat does are. And they're just all going crazy. Where the does, let's face it, they got their pattern. And they're not going to change because they're in heat. They don't change. They don't start cruising around looking for other does. I mean, they stay in their pattern. So a good opportunity for that buck to, you know, to have his fun is when she's out in her movement to from her feeding to her bedding.
His harem. And that happens at night. Harem.
That happens at night.
Now, that buck there, he bred a doe two or three times in the time that I was tracking him before I killed him. He had a doe with him. He wasn't going to leave her. And actually, she cost him his life. He was breeding this doe right in the middle of the day. And that was unusual for us. She was, maybe he was with her for a day or two and she wasn't in the heat, and then all of a sudden she came into heat and he wasn't going to leave her. And that's just pretty much what it amounted to. He wasn't going to leave her till he bred her.
I think that's what it boils down to.
Yeah. Because they'll know. I mean, they'll go up to a doe and she ain't ready yet. Well, I'm going to go get another one. I'm going to come back and check this one because this one might be ready tomorrow. That's their job right now, is to breed does.
The end of the second week of the main season, they're really starting to move.
He just can't stand
it. And that's
the
time of year. When you cannot be in camp.
You can't be.
You know, you just can't be.
No.
You got to be in the woods.
I told
you. It makes no difference. Five after one. No, excuse me. 10 after one. 5 after one. Yours was 5 after one.
Noon.
Exactly noon.
Noon, exactly noon. 5 after one.
The best time of
the day. 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock. 10 o'clock. All these times are when bucks are, you know.
Most people are gone home.
Yeah, they go in the woods for 3 or 4 hours and they go home, you know, and stuff like that. They don't realize that big buck, the minute he gets done his breeding all night, he wants to rest. And then about 11 o'clock, he wants to get up and get something to eat. He's hungry, you know. It's just like.
And then he eats a little bit. And most generally after he eats, he'll lay down again. But he'll be up before you know it and start cruising around.
Yeah.
That deer there, he was looking for a doe. He had his nose right on the ground. He's 5 just, after one.
Just cruising around. Yep.
The Rut was produced by Erica Heilman for the Vermont Folklife Center. You may still not be convinced it's a marvelous thing to wander around the woods blowing up ungulates. But then, at least for some of us, that's not what hunting is really about.
A lot of water.
That's why it's so ideal.
Oh, yeah.
And every one of them has a lot of sign around it, too, so they use them all.
Yeah.
The first night of the hunt, hands that carried guns all day picked up guitars. A dozen people sat around the fire and ate the dense, flavorful meat from an elk killed the previous year. I took it as a sign that this occasion mattered a lot to them. It must, if the hunters would eat game from the previous hunt, almost as a ritual, I thought. And each of them had arranged lives with all the normal complications so that they could meet at Squaw Meadow in the Payette National Forest in the mountains of central Idaho. Some had been hunting this place for several years. Others were new to it. They had married into one another's clan or had worked together. Most were from Idaho, although it was a man from back east who got the first elk that morning.
One of the amazing things about elk is they have some power to suddenly appear where you least expect them and disappear as quick as you blink an eye. And suddenly in this thick brush, there was this elk just standing there looking at me.
Everett Toll of Washington, D.C., who was hunting with his son, Leonard. Everett had a new rifle with a fine, clear, telescopic sight mounted on it. But that morning, when he saw the elk and put the gun to his shoulder, his first shot was no good.
I think I shot a little too quick. He was in the brush. I could only see his head, and I tried to shoot him in the neck and missed. And he went behind a tree, and when he stepped out of the tree, he turned and looked right at me, and I shot him again in the head. So he dropped instantly, and it was about 5 miles from here, which meant the work began then. It took, four of us? Best part of the afternoon just to get him out, so it was a long afternoon.
Why wouldn't you just come out here to the forest, to hike around the forest for a day? What is it about hunting and shooting that is an attraction?
I think, first of all, I do like to come out and hike around, but I think the hunting is an extra dimension. It's a challenge to you. It's something that you can do as a team. Somehow it just adds another dimension to being out here. And I don't consider myself an avid hunter. I like the outdoors, but I always look forward to getting out hunting for some reason with a gun, and something that Leonard and I enjoy doing together. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I'd basically agree with that. And it is, to some extent, it is, you know, it's kind of thrilling. We see probably more wildlife every year than the normal person does in their lifetime that doesn't hunt. And that's got to be worth something. We enjoy the animals as much as anything. Even though we may end up killing one, doesn't mean that we don't like them. We really enjoy the wildlife. And not many people get up at odd hours and hike 15 or 20 miles a day to see wildlife.
The hunter said the real work began after the kill. He meant carrying the animal out, carrying the meat out. Even gutted and quartered, elk are big creatures, and the cut-up portions are heavy. They're awkward to carry down miles of trails and back to camp. The camp was a site between a dirt road and a wide, shallow stream. Some horses were tied by trees near the water. There were tents nearer the road. Some, the new, colorful nylon dome types. Others were big, dull army canvas. And there was one beautiful place of light and warmth, a heavy white cook tent with a peaked roof and a small steel shepherd stove and a cook.
Is there a trick to being a camp cook?
No.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I don't have to get up and cook them breakfast. I fix coffee the night before and take the grounds out of it, and then I just say, it's ready. All you got to do is turn it on.
Judy Fee, the wife of one of the two men at the center of the hunting group. Other women came to visit the camp occasionally, although I saw only men go out to hunt. Judy was there almost all the time. We talked at dawn one morning after everyone was gone. We had coffee by the fire. She was in a pale flannel nightgown that was turned inside out and worn over red long johns and old white leather high-top sneakers. She seemed completely at home in the hunting camp.
It's more fun to be out here. See them when they bring the meat in and listen to their stories when they come in. And I like fooling with the horses. I like cooking. And I wouldn't like to just sit home while they were off hunting. Plus, I'm gathering information for my book. Book of hunting stories and what they go through and things that happen to them while they're hunting. Like horses heading back to town. Hunters never can find anything. Where's my gun? Where's my shells? I can't find my sleeping bag, like I use all this stuff. So they can't get ready for the hunt unless the wife tells them where everything is. So it'll be fun. It's a funny story already.
One time, she said, her husband and some of the others were camped somewhere, and they'd taken along with them a man who was too old to hunt anymore. He didn't even have a license. He had to stay in camp. But when they returned there in the evening, the old man had a fresh-killed elk hanging from a limb. "Why did you shoot it?" they asked. Some of them worked for the Forest Service, and they wondered how they would explain this if they were caught. "I didn't shoot it," the old man replied. "Someone did, but I didn't. It wandered into camp bleeding, and it keeled over and died." This story was so unlikely, they all agreed it might be true.
I can give you lots of hunting stories. It's not real unless it's coming from the guides sitting around the campfire or at home or around the table with a can of beer, and they actually get this paper out like they're going to really make a list, you know, list of what they're going to take, things they're not going to forget, and secretly things they don't have to ask their wife where it is. But they never get anything down on this paper but a bunch of scratches and doodles. The first thing that's always on the list is the name of the guys that are going. And that gets added to by tenfold before a hunting trip ever gets there. And they talk about the food they're going to take, like they're hungry already. You know, they can't wait till they get there. And now we want this and we want that. And are you going to fix this? And are you going to fix that? The hunting trip gets there and I don't care. What do you guys want? I don't fix anything. I don't care. But during the year, see these flat elbows? These flat elbows come from leaning through hours of these hunting stories. And every story changes. And I'm sitting there going, well, that's not how you told it the last time. And it makes me laugh. I could sit for hours and listen to them.
At night in the camp, it was so cold you would wake up again and again and think about sleeping in a bed. It was still dark when the hunters got up, 6 or 7 or 8 of them.
It's time to go.
We gotta go,
guys.
Yeah,
it's starting to light up.
Hey, good luck. Might see you having caught, huh?
Okay. Right.
They wore heavy clothes and hats and gloves. They were all green and brown to blend with the woods. Some wore orange, so they wouldn't blend so much as to tempt another shooter. They started a fire. They warmed coffee. They mixed instant oatmeal with hot water. They stood around talking quietly. They formed into small groups, and before it was light, moved across the road and into the trees. The hunters would begin returning in the middle of the afternoon. They told each other what had happened in this day going by. By their testimony, hunting comes down to knowing how to find your way in the woods and on being lucky enough to find something. And then it is a matter of skill with a gun. There were guns all around, rifles. People were comfortable with them, but handled them carefully nonetheless. One man said he thought hunting rifles are used as guns are supposed to be used, but that perhaps there should be restrictions on handguns in the city. Another was skeptical that any rules would bother those who actually deserved to be restricted. Perhaps the finest hunter in the camp was Jeff Fee, the husband of the cook, Judy. He had the only rifle I saw that did not have a fancy scope. It was the only gun that looked old, but Fee was said to be an excellent shot with it. When he went off on horseback in the morning, he carried it in a leather scabbard that fit under the right stirrup strap of his saddle.
My gun is called a 308 Savage. And the Savage made these lever-action guns. I'm not sure if it was a 308 caliber, but they made these lever-action guns back about the turn of the century. I don't know ballistics, and I don't really care about ballistics. It's a gun that I use to get meat. I don't hunt trophy. I don't hunt antlers. I kill that animal myself. I have a prayer for that animal. That animal actually becomes a part of me, gives me strength, make it through my life, And in my belief, there's no such thing as a death. Things go on and on and on.
This was said on the last night I spent in the camp. The next day, the hunters were out again for another long walk in the mountains. They found nothing. Indeed, when a week had passed and the hunt was over, some of them had not fired even one shot. But Jeff Fee had also said that such days did not discourage him, and that most often he managed to achieve what it was he was really seeking in the hunt.
When I go out in the hills, of course, I enjoy elk hunting, but it happens to be in an area that's very, very sacred to me. It's a place where I regain my spirit. It's very, very high in the peaks. And, you know, everybody has their own belief and their own church and their own religion. Well, mine happened to be at the base of those peaks in a very, very special area to me. And I don't need to find an elk. I mean, if one comes along, fine. And I don't need to shoot a deer either. When I see those peaks and I'm underneath those, it just it revives me. Makes me feel like life's all worth it again.
Alex Chadwick in an Idaho hunting camp, produced by Carolyn Jensen Chadwick, engineered by Michael Schweppe. I'm Larry Massett. This is HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.